Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm John Wildermuth, a political reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Today's program is generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. IOUs, state spending cuts, higher taxes and layoffs are just some of the harsh realities of the California state budget. On May 19th, residents will have their say about approving some of the budget details in a statewide special election. Before Golden State residents cast their ballots, they need to know what a yes or no vote means to their futures and the future of our state. Our panel of experts will assess the state's challenges and lay out the details of the budget plan. They are John Chang, California State Controller, John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief, KQED Public Radio, Sean Randolph, President and CEO, Bay Area Economic Forum, and Fred Silva, Senior Fiscal Advisor, California Forward. We'll start out with John Chang. Controller, what's the latest state budget picture, and is there any light at the end of this tunnel?
Well, first of all, good afternoon. It's a great pleasure to be with all of you. I think we're at a point where it's the calm before the storm once again, unfortunately. There are significant challenges as we will enter the new fiscal year. The revenue picture for the month of April was not as strong as we had hoped, and certainly in light of what the original budget estimates were. In fact, the LAO came out yesterday and said that we are $1.8 billion short. If you look at the governor's numbers and the LAO's numbers for next year, the LAO expects that we will be $8 billion short with no further revenue deterioration on top of what he projected. And if you look at the governor's cash numbers, he expects that we would need we will be in the red by $10.6 billion in the month of December. To put that in perspective, that is twice as large as the worst projected point for this fiscal year. If we had continued without the legislature and the governor coming to agreement in February, we had expected to be $5.3 billion in the red. And we had already started to experience some of the consequences of the state not being in a firm and strong cash position. We had to delay non-legally protected payments, including some payments to large private sector vendors, the state's contribution to the SSI, which hurts vulnerable populations such as seniors and the disabled. We had to stop making payments to public institutions of higher education, the Cal Grants. So students were impacted or would have been impacted if we worked with the leadership of higher education to make sure that they did not take action against the students because the state was, in fact, not making those payments for Cal Grants. And so if you imagine that and then imagine the legally protected payment categories, there are cash management steps that we engage in the controller's office. The first is the use of general revenue funds, which are personal income taxes, corporate taxes, sales taxes, followed by special fund payments, followed by other types of payments that will be cut into. And so we will talk about Medi-Cal payments. We'll look at pension payments. If we do not come to resolving this issue during this summer.
Thank you. Fred Silva. What is your take on the proposed budget?
Well, the legislature and the governor agreed on a spending plan for the 2009-10 fiscal year. That is the one that starts in July. They did that back in February. And the budget that they put together on the face of it was balanced because they raised some taxes, they reduced spending, and their view of the economy at the time was that it was balanced. Now, they knew that there were things that needed to be done with initiative measures that had been passed, so they've asked the voters to make some changes in initiative measures to save some resources. They also thought that it was time to do some amount of changes in the way the fiscal structure works. And so they put Prop 1A on the ballot, and this whole budget agreement assumed that the economy would begin to recover in late 2009G. We're in April, or May rather, and hopefully in early 2010. Well, but we know that that isn't going to happen, and so the economy's deteriorated, so has the budget settlement. And as the controller mentioned, the current budget that we're in is in the hole, and we knew it would be in the hole, running a deficit of probably $4 to $5 billion. The current year going into 9-10. We also know now that 9-10 is out of balance. So if you look at the program reductions that were done in order to achieve a balance for the 2019 year, you're going to have to do either more reductions in that budget plan, or you'll have to increase some taxes in order to achieve balance in 2010. That's June 30th, 2010. So the challenge to all of us is to try to figure out how to achieve some amount of fiscal balance in the system. The state, over the last decade plus, last 10 to 12 years, has not done a good job in achieving fiscal balance. It isn't a high priority. The high priority is to try to keep spending on what we call a current services curve, which means you get what you got in the prior year plus growth. And the debate's always about plus growth. How much more can we get in a given program? And I'm afraid that fiscal balance has just not been one of those things that governors, several of them, and legislatures, several of those, have paid much attention to. So the challenge really is how to get to fiscal balance in the midst of a serious economic decline.
As soon as we finish this opening group of statements, we're going to be taking questions. So if anybody has questions out there, write them on the blue cards, hold them up, and I'm sure there'll be somebody to pick them up. Thanks. Let's go to Sean Randolph. How does this budget help and hurt the state?
Well, I may rephrase the question a little bit and ask, why are we here today, or maybe why we are here today? Because it hurts the state, it hurts the economy, it hurts everybody who's on the receiving end of a state program, it hurts taxpayers. But just to step back, we've been here before. This is not the first serious fiscal crisis in California. In fact, if you recall the last one, 2003-2004, that's when Gray Davis was recalled and Arnold Schwarzenegger was elected, and we were in deep water then. So, but people don't remember that this is not new territory. It's more severe, but we are suffering from the same structural issues, just more extreme than we've been suffering from in the past. So February 2004, so my organization, the Economic Institute, and partners in Silicon Valley, joint venture Silicon Valley, got together a group of really smart people, and we knew we couldn't solve the immediate budget problem, but we said, what are the things you could do that would structurally change the budget system so we didn't have to go through this again? And we created this statement of principles. For those on the radio, I'm waving a piece of paper here, and it says, California Budget and Tax Reform, February 2004. And I'll just read one or two lines from here. Budget shortfall, unprecedented, attributable to two factors, large declines in tax receipts, escalating government costs, unstable components of the personal income tax contributed to volatility, fall in personal income tax revenues due to recession and declining stock markets, drop in revenues from capital gains and stock options. So a lot of the reasons why we are in the problem. Saying this has exposed major structural problems in the underlying budget process and pointing to the failure of the governor and the legislature, this was 2003 and 4, to adequately constrain spending as revenues fell, exacerbated by the magnitude of the deficit and its social and economic consequences. And then the statement of principles talks about a number of things like reduction in the most volatile components of revenue, like income tax, talks about the need for multi-year budgeting, performance-based budgeting, rainy day reserves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, and also, well, 8 or 10 major items. Well, that wasn't rocket science. We knew 5 years ago, and others like Fred, who worked on these issues years and years before that, knew how you go about solving these problems, and they're structural in nature. But 5 years later, we're in deeper water, a bigger problem, and guess what? Essentially nothing has been done to solve the structural problem. So Prop 1A, I think it's a good thing. With Prop 1B, it is at least a structural fix. But I think as we get into deeper waters, as the controller was just saying, the severity of these issues becomes greater and greater, and the failure, especially of the legislature, to resolve the underlying structural issues really explains a lot of why where we are today. It's deep because of the recession, but had we addressed these structural issues 5 years ago or before that, we wouldn't be having this conversation today.
Thank you. John Myers, what if we go into a new budget session with the deficits we have now, and there, people are looking to pull them together, what's going to happen up in the Capitol?
I think what happens in the Capitol is largely what we have seen before, which is gridlock. There are no easy answers to getting out of this. I'm reminded this week that we're sitting here talking, the field poll came out with its newest numbers on the special election measures, which all look pretty dismal, save for one. And Field also asked people about what they would cut and what they would be willing to have a tax increase on. And not surprisingly, people didn't want to cut anything, and they didn't want to raise any taxes. And so when people talk about the dysfunction of the legislature, I somewhat and that it doesn't reflect the needs of California, I actually sometimes think it reflects the problem of California too much. Californians have a disconnect between the size of government they've come to expect and the government they're willing to pay for, and the legislature seems to reflect that year after year. We sat through the fall and into early winter with this 18-month budget solution that has been talked about here, this $40 billion deficit fix. And it was a very, very hard, long, grueling set of negotiations that resulted in a amount of taxes, an amount of cuts, and in an amount of borrowing, which frankly is borrowing from future revenues of the lottery should Prop 1C pass. And the likelihood even of that solution happening again, I think, unfortunately, the odds are small. Republicans aren't interested in raising any more taxes. Democrats want to hold the line on some of these spending cuts that they think are too severe. And I think we'll be back at this. And I one other thing that crossed my mind as we were sitting here and listening to everyone else talk about kind of the state of where we are, is I thought of a comment that Governor Schwarzenegger made on an election night 5 years ago, and I'm paraphrasing him here. I should have brought the exact quote, but he said something to the effect of, "This means never again will we be in this position. You know, now we will never be in this position again. We have fixed it." That's what he said when Proposition 58 passed. If you remember Prop 58 in 2004, it was the Balanced Budget Initiative, which basically said the legislature has to balance the budget. Well, they've done that. It balances on paper. And it also created a reserve fund, a smaller reserve fund than we're talking about now, and one that they could take the money out of or suspend the money easier than they could if Prop 1A passes. And so this notion that Californians thought they solved the problem but really didn't, I think only exacerbates the problem of the legislature, where there's this tremendous disconnect about not only what we want but how we move forward.
John, you mentioned a poll that was yesterday, the field poll that showed what voters want. We have a question here saying that voters don't want to pay more taxes, but they also don't want to receive less services. How do we address this attitude of denial? Start with you, Fred.
Well, that attitude of denial is reflected in how legislatures and governors build budgets. They look at the question of revenues not being sufficient in order to maintain spending at a level that people are interested in, and so the release valve has been borrow money. And so we've been through this process of borrowing money in order to finance budgets. There was a time when fiscal balance, that is to say balancing revenues and expenditures, was the high priority and you didn't borrow money in order to achieve fiscal balance. We lost that some years ago. You can put the date at about 10 to 12 years ago when we lost that. A notion that you don't borrow money for operating expenses. Well, the state has been borrowing money for operating expenses. So the release valve is where you get into a conflict, and one group says, nope, we're not going to reduce spending anymore, and the other group says, nope, we're not going to raise taxes, and all of a sudden somebody says, well, you could borrow money to get your way out of it, and that's the release valve. And so unfortunately, that's an era that we have kind of fallen into so that you can get to a, quote, balance, a balanced budget by having borrowed resources in there in order to finance spending.
Anybody else want to touch that one?
Yeah. This is an area of significant concern, and I think it's an area that has not received the attention it truly deserves. As I pointed out a bit earlier, one of the issues in terms of cash management for the state of California is that this state has not been net cash positive since July 12, 2007. So in excess of a year and a half, we've been operating on borrowed funds. The cash figures that have been presented only talk about, in essence, the general operations through general funds deficiencies that we have in this state. Our state has borrowed in excess of $16.5 billion that ultimately needs to be repaid back. The special funds are things are such as the tire recycling fee, the oil spill prevention fee. If we have an oil spill off the coast of California, those monies are immediately drawable. And then you have other types of action. I've been able to get legislative change to fix the unclaimed property program, but in essence, that's still $5 billion that we owe back to property owners here in the state of California, and that is another $5 billion that ultimately you have to account for. So we have all these pots of money that need to be aggregated so that people, if we're going to come clean about the state's finances, have to be identified and addressed.
I might add something on that, that this has been an issue showing up in polls for many, many, many years, the fact that people don't see the connection between what they pay in taxes and the services. But that being the case, that's not going to change right away. The legislature is elected to legislate. They're elected to lead. And one of the structural problems we've had for years and years in Sacramento has been we haven't had performance-based budgeting. You start your program with the budget for the previous year, and then you build in on top of that. And you have this escalating expenditure pattern that basically gets locked in. And what happened, especially prior to 2003 in the last crisis, was revenues in good years were put into programs that were then on automatic escalators. Once they're locked in, they just go up every year. So we've seen a pretty dramatic growth in spending over the last 5 years because the economy has been pretty good, but we haven't learned the lesson from the past. So I think when we have our legislators in Sacramento and they're elected to represent us, they need to think not only about the polls, but they also need to be leading. And these decisions about spending and automatic escalators, most voters don't think about that. They're not even aware of that. So I think it's really up to our elected officials to lead in a way that they haven't and look at how you structurally change the budget process and just not keep on spending.
I don't want to make this question go too long, but I would say one other thing that's fascinating as a reporter to watch, which is the intersection of what the legislature does and what the voters do at the polls. And it has become a very problematic intersection with the voters approving particular things that then force the legislature to move in a particular direction. Not that they shouldn't move that way, but the more that that's happened, the more difficult I think this process has gotten. And I, in watching the debate about taxes this year and watching all of this, and there's a palpable anger. The economy is bad. I mean, let's not forget that the economy is at a unbelievable historic low, and so these tax increases are coming at the same time that we're in this budget deal. I would not be surprised. You watch the populist anger out there. I wouldn't be surprised to see someone quickly put an initiative out for a part-time legislature. Say, this is it. We're done. We're sick with those guys. And then talk about the kinds of things that change in California. So, I mean, this feels very similar to the recall of 2003, where people were really angry. But their anger this time, I don't think, is a governor as much as it is systemic. So,
you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today, we're discussing the California budget. Our panelists are John Chang, California State Controller, John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief, KQED Public Radio, Sean Randolph, President and CEO, Bay Area Economic Forum, and Fred Silva, Senior Fiscal Advisor, California Forward. John Myers, let's go a little bit more about what you were saying. And one of the questions that comes up is the question of ballot box budgeting. We have a question here from someone talking about Prop 1D and Prop 1E. And we're asked, instead of taking part of Prop 63 and Prop 10 funds, why can't we take all of them, put them in the general fund, and through another ballot measure?
Well, I mean, I think anything's possible. I think What's fascinating is that you know, and I know others on this panel are more expert about this, but what's fascinating is that, you know, that the governor and the legislature in this budget deal in February are going to the voters to ask them to undo things the voters have done before. And I think this gets back to this notion of that difficult intersection between the ballot measure process and the legislative process. And so, you know, theoretically you could, but when you look at the polling, people don't want to take the money from those programs. I mean, 1D funds programs through a tobacco tax that was originally Prop 10, which is money for early childhood programs. People think that's invaluable. Prop 1E was a tax on people who make over $1 million in California to go for mental health services. People think that's valuable. And so the polling shows that people don't want to take that out. But, yeah, theoretically you could. You could remove all of that money. And it is, in a way, it's to what Fred Silva talked about earlier, it's borrowing. And Prop 1C is a great example of that. Talk about short-term fix for long-term effect. It's $5 billion in future revenues from the California lottery that investors will give you the money up front and want it back over time with interest, assuming the lottery actually makes money. So, you know, we have always looked for a way around the cuts versus taxes dynamic.
But isn't there a concern that that money is being taken through taxes for specific purposes, which makes those tax directions a lot less available for the future? Mr. Controller?
It does handicap our ability to maneuver in the future. I think that's part of the pattern and practice that has gotten us into the great troubles that we are in today. Fred pointed out appropriately that for too long we've engaged in significant borrowing. If you look at the budget and the fastest growing portions of the budget, percentage-wise, it is going to be debt repayment. Do we want to limit our options for the future in terms of our ability to pay for infrastructure, for healthcare, for education by our use of those monies for operating concerns today? I think the answer has to be no, that we have to enforce better fiscal discipline and that we have to make those difficult choices. We're only pushing on our problems to our kids and our grandkids.
Fred Silva?
Now, let me add one element of hope here. As we look down deeper and deeper into this quagmire, California Forward had suggested a number of fiscal reforms. One of them was that when the state looks at new programs or increases in existing programs, that there ought to be a method for financing. And it's this so-called PAYGO model that the federal government had some years ago, and believe it or not, in the current federal budget resolution, they want to put it back. And the notion is that as programs expand or new programs, that there ought to be a method for financing them. Because we've long held that all of us collectively as a society have thought, well, as the state grows, and it always seems to grow, that the resources available for program expansion will be there. And we're learning that we've done that so many times, either through the initiative measure or through measures adopted by the legislature and signed by the governor, that we've corralled so much of the growth of our revenue base of a growing economy that we can't finance the outcomes. We can't finance them anymore. So we've suggested a number of things aside from looking at multi-year budgeting and some solutions that have been talked about over a long period of time. We think more fiscal discipline has to be added to a so-called PAYGO mechanism that says you've got an idea for a new program, then you ought to finance it. That does not mean that you simply say, gee, let's do more child development and raise cigarette taxes for it. It means that the general fund itself ought to have sufficient resources in it to finance new program growth.
I might add on what John was saying, that the initiative process is part of this structural gridlock we've gotten ourselves into where, you know, Californians love the initiative. They're never going to give it up. But it's been used over the last couple of decades in ways that it probably wasn't intended to be used for. So it was really a populist process when it was first created, giving power to the people. But I think a lot more special or narrow interests have really seized a lot of the control or are using that process more aggressively now. So what we're seeing over the years is the accumulation of a series of interesting and often attractive propositions to fund X, Y, or Z, often without a dedicated source for that funding, as Fred is pointing out. And, you know, you may like mental health services or you may like preschool programs. Each one of these ideas may be very worthy in itself, but when you start to accumulate them, you have this series of one-off ideas, each of which takes a slice out of the general fund. And in the end, what the legislature is left with, and you can't fault them for this, a much smaller share of general fund revenues over which they actually have some discretionary authority for making decisions. So one of these big structural fixes we may need to look at is fixing the initiative process, not doing away with it necessarily, but maybe we have a sunset clause in the initiative. You've got to revisit it. It dies after 5 years, and you vote on it again to see if it worked. But I just don't think we can go on indefinitely taking a slice at a time for special projects out of the budget and think we're solving our problems.
John Chang?
Yeah, I actually, along the lines that you talked about, perhaps a sunset clause, I wanted to create greater financial flexibility for the future. And so one of the things I wanted to do was to, for future bills that have financial consequences, such as tax credits, that you would automatically have a sunset, so it would come up for a review. It takes a two-thirds vote to change a lot of these tax provisions. So, for instance, let's say we had something positive and you enacted a tax credit. Well, if we wanted to eliminate that tax credit, let's say they created a tax credit to try to enhance jobs in a certain area here in California, that industry later on was very successful. It didn't need those tax credits. It's nearly impossible to eliminate that tax credit. And so we're losing the possibilities of greater tax revenues to use for other purposes here in California. So I'm introducing and sponsoring legislation that says let's implement a sunset clause to that provision so that we can once again look at that act to see if we can need to continue to provide support to that industry. Secondly, in terms of the ballot measures, why don't we tell people what are the financial consequences of this particular ballot measure? Is it going to lock up 10% of the state's budget in the future so that we have less financial flexibility? I think it's important that as we continue along with this process, that we heighten the understanding of the budgetary and financial consequences of our decisions.
One of the big concerns of any sort of financial problem or slowdown is the confidence of people out there. And I have a couple of questions like that. One person says, I've always invested in California bonds and promptly rolled over the bonds when they were called, but I have not purchased any bonds for almost 2 years. Am I being overly pessimistic? And taking it right to the point, someone else asked, are California state general obligation bonds safe going forward? And we'll start with the controller on this one.
Well, just so that you know, I'm not registered as an investment advisor, so I'm not going to tell you whether to invest or not. So it's just general parameters. I don't want to overstep the bounds. Your confidence in purchasing California bonds, GO bonds, or municipal bonds depends on your ability. Do you think that the state can continue to exist? Right? Will we go into default? I strongly believe we're not going to go into default, even where you've had municipalities have significant financial problems, such as Orange County some years back. They ultimately made payments on their bonds. They did not pay all of them timely, but ultimately they were all repaid. And if you're looking at some of the rates now, those Build America bonds that were sold, 7.4%, the federal government's going to provide 35% assistance to our state, that's not a bad return. So think about the security, the guarantee of the state. In essence, if California's going to go under, you're going to have the United States go under. So I'm betting on the prospects of California because I'm betting on just certainly because of California and what we have here, but I'm certainly betting on the United States of America.
Fred Silva.
And just to add to that, keep in mind that both the state issues general obligation bonds that have full faith and credit behind them, but municipal governments do the same. And the municipal governments have the property tax that supports the debt service. And we have not in our state's history defaulted either at the state level for a state general obligation bond because it's got the full faith and credit behind it, or a municipal government that had issued a general obligation bond, again, supported by a fixed tax rate. All of you, when you support a general obligation bond at the local level, when you vote for that, you vote for two things. One is you say, my local government or school district, go ahead and borrow some money for that fixed asset that you want to build, and I'm approving my property taxes going up. Because if you look at your tax bill, you have the 1% rate, then you have the debt rate tied to it. So the notion that somehow general obligation indebtedness is threatened I would argue, is a vast overstatement, because both at the state level and certainly at the community level, they're supported, obviously, by the local property tax rates, and at the state level, by the full faith and credit of the general fund, because the treasurer inevitably is going to make those payments when you go to the window and say, I'm ready to redeem my my bonds here, it gets paid.
But again, when you start talking about serious budget problems for a state, people start worrying. They start saying, how is this going to affect me? We have another question here asking, you know, two questions actually. One wants to know, what's the financial health of CalPERS? And the other one wants to know, what are the legal obligations regarding paying pensions? People wanting to know what the state will do to, again, follow up with its obligations. And I think we've got to go to the controller on this one, too.
Sure. The pension obligations through CalPERS are CalSTRS, our legal obligations. They're protected under the Constitution, and so those payments have to be made. CalPERS and CalSTRS have both had difficult years. Our funding ratios have dropped, but you have to invest over the long-term horizon, and so we will make those obligations. So we're going to obviously try to reduce the obligations on the employers and what they have to put into the system where you have years of negative performance. Our discount rate at CalPERS is 7.75%. We were close to 3% in terms of our minus 3% for our return, but you know, for when you look at the years prior to where you had 14% plus return, and hopefully we'll get more positive returns in the future, we will be close to what our actual responsibilities will be. But we do have to make significant adjustments, and we have to make a major retooling in terms of what's happening in the current market.
Anybody else want to touch that? Okay, we have a whole bunch of questions about the upcoming election, and we'll get to those after we ask one more question. Some people have flocked to the idea of a constitutional convention to rework the structure of spending. What are the thoughts about something like that? And I'm going to start with Fred Silva, who knows all about constitutional revision.
Well, John, there are a couple of things people need to think about. One of them is, how do you want to proceed with reviewing the state's governance and fiscal apparatus? I was involved with the Constitution Revision Commission, which met in the 90s, and the idea was to have some deliberative body look at both governance and fiscal issues. I'm now involved with California Forward, and California Forward's kind of general view is we ought to take a look at both governance and fiscal issues and work within in the existing system in order to bring the attention of the citizenry to the legislature and the governor about institutional change. Now, what we're at about a midpoint in that, and I know there's been a great deal of interest to say, well, what about a convention? The issues around calling a convention are this. How broad do you want the debate to go about the current provisions in the Constitution? The last time we went through a major revision of the Constitution was in the 1960s when a revision commission produced proposals to the voters to do some rewriting. They took a relatively long constitution and reduced it. Didn't make a lot of policy changes, but they trimmed an otherwise somewhat cumbersome document down, basically taking statutory provisions out of the Constitution and then putting them in statute where they belong. Well, the last time we had a convention was in 1879. And those of you who recall that history know that there were the Kearneyites, right? Do we have Kearneys here in San Francisco, right? Major
we
part.
We have the street.
We do indeed. You do indeed. There was the labor. There were labor issues, and there were corporate issues. This was capitalists versus labor. There's a huge conflict about it. Should you go to a convention, don't assume that you won't have those major interest group clashes again. Because you will, because everybody has some form of an interest. So we've suggested at California Forward that we have some deliberative process to get to the voters some discrete governance changes and some changes in our fiscal structure, and that dialogue ought to go on, perhaps preceding any call for a convention.
Anybody else want to?
Yeah, I'll weigh in on that.
Sean?
I've had a lot of involvement over the years with California Forward and its predecessor, New California Network, and the parent organization that the Institute is part of the Bay Area Council is actually the organization that's put forward this constitutional convention idea. And I think it's really the content is very compatible. I think that the principles about the reform of state governance related to the budget, related to the electoral process, I think everybody's on common ground there. We're really looking at two different pathways, and one is a more incremental one, sort of systematic one, and the other you could maybe call it the nuclear option. The convention is a nuclear option, and it's nuclear in the sense that it potentially explosive, that could be good or bad in its implications, when you say we're going to redesign the entire system, or we're going to redesign those elements of the system that we choose to redesign. There's a lot of issues, as Fred pointed out. Can you actually control the process so it stays on track? Can you insulate it from special interests? Hard to do. How do you go about selecting the delegates? There are a whole bunch of options, but that would need to be decided. It would take right now you can only call a convention by an act of the legislature unless they choose to do it, which isn't likely right now. There would probably need to be a ballot measure and two back-to-back. One, to authorize a constitutional change for the people to call the convention, and then the second one, to actually call the convention. And then you could move it forward from there. So it's a complicated process with a pretty high level of risk because it's on new ground. The reason that it's interesting right now and may become more interesting after the ballot next month is it's the level of frustration in the system right now. As I was saying earlier, a lot of the solutions have been identified for a long time, and a lot of the solutions we could probably in this room agree upon, but they just haven't happened. So we've been through one extremely severe budget crisis 5 years ago, another one now. We know the frustration with the electoral process, and there's been progress on that. But I think maybe the level of anxiety among voters and Californians in general at the evident failure of the system in Sacramento as a whole, the evident failure of the legislature to resolve the fundamental issues that legislators were sent there to resolve, may be taking us up to a new qualitative threshold where people are actually prepared to say, you know, we're just going to start all over again here and accept that risk. So it's I think what happens the next month on the ballot is going to have a big impact. If the measures pass, if 1A and 1B pass, and if they all pass, then we still have big issues, as John said, and the legislature and the governor work them through. But if, in fact, the measures fail, then we're deeper than we were before in some very difficult waters. I think voters may see further evidence of failure, and that may push them more toward the more radical solution of a constitutional convention than they would have been inclined to do just a few months ago.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're discussing the California budget. Our panelists are John Chang, California State Controller, John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief, KQED Public Radio, Sean Randolph, President and CEO, Bay Area Economic Forum, and Fred Silva, Senior Fiscal Advisor, California Forward. When we talk about the budget measures coming up on the special election ballot, the first thing everybody wants to talk about is Prop 1A, which is would provide for a spending cap, would provide for a larger rainy day fund, would give the governor more power to fix the budget stuff without going to the legislature if the budget's out of balance, and would also trigger about $16 billion in tax extensions. That's a lot of moving parts. And what are the arguments, both for and against it? And why don't we start with John Myers on this one?
Well, I would say that one of the things, first off, to understand Prop 1A, and I've spent what I feel almost is a painful amount of time trying to understand the details in it, but that's the job you get as a reporter. But I think to understand Prop 1A, first of all, you have to walk out a couple of the terms that are being used in the campaign. Spending cap. Well, I think, to be fair, it's probably a spending restraint. It is not a fundamental cap on the amount of spending the state can do. That's largely because it creates a rolling 10-year average of what revenues come into the state. Anything above that would get automatically pushed into a reserve fund. The second is this notion, but also on that, I should say, too, the language of Prop 1A does not ban a tax increase if you want to spend more money in a given year. Of course, a tax increase isn't easy to get. It takes a two-thirds vote. But so it does not cap spending. It restrains it, I think probably is a fair way to call it. On the reserve fund, too, I think also the notion of it being a rainy day fund, well, that's great for the supporters of 1A, and some of it certainly is there for bad times. A portion of that money, if 1B passes, automatically goes to public schools, about $1.5 billion a year for the short run. And so it's not all reserves. Some of it is just a set-aside, I think. And so I think the fundamental question, pro or con on 1A, do you want to restrain the way that the state spends money? Do you want to say we need to have a better way of estimating revenues and projecting what revenues are real? I know folks like Fred Silva have looked at this for a long time about, you know, these up and down notions of when we rely on personal income taxes so much, you know, what's the appropriate amount that we should expect to be spending and what should go somewhere else? So I think, you know, the pro side says we've got to push that off. The no side clearly is going to say this linear regression formula that you get revenues out of is complicated. You're putting it in the Constitution, and you're also layering it on top of other voter measures that have been approved, most notably the education funding guarantee, Prop 98. The interplay between Prop 98 and Prop 1A, I think, will be fascinating to watch if this passes. 98 could ostensibly take up more and more of the budget, more education funding, less money for other programs. So there's really a fascinating argument, I think, about whether we are – and again, this is one of the problems with 1A. You mentioned the tax increase, John. Are we talking about systemic change for state government, or are we talking about get us out of the hole now? And if you're talking about both, how do you convince voters that you're really going to do both?
This is a very complicated issue to put before voters on a ballot measure. How do you see it, Fred?
Well, there's an interesting thing going on here. One of them is that there's this expectation that it's going to solve, that by the proponents, that it's going to solve everything. And I would argue that it's only going to solve one, I'm going to say narrow, but very important problem. And if you look back at the last 10 years of budgets, and you can take whatever period of time you want, we have this boom and bust budgeting system in California where the legislature and the governor like to spend every nickel that comes in the door. So if you go back and look, you have a couple of years of really big budgets that grow by 10 or 12%, and everybody's happy. Interest groups are happy. The education community is happy. Health and Human Services delivery efforts are happy. And then the following year, you get a minus 1% budget, which means the legislature and governor went in and stripped everything out of it, and everybody had cuts. Following year, the budget grew by 1%. Everybody got cuts. Following year after that, it grew by less than 1%, and everybody got cuts. Out of 10 budgets, 6 of them had to be taken apart. So the other 4, everybody got a lot of money. And the main lesson to be learned with Prop 1A is the idea that you ought to put some stability into funding. So when you get a spike in revenue, don't put it in the spending base, put it in the reserve. So that when revenues decline, you don't have to tear everything apart again and get a 1% budget. Yeah, maybe you can help finance a 4 or 5% budget to keep the status quo programs and not reduce cost of living adjustments and take apart provider rates for health services. And I think the main message of Prop 1A is let's fix this one piece of the pie here, not the whole thing, but they're really looking at this volatility problem and trying to even out public expenditures.
John Chang, how serious is the volatility program on state budgeting?
It is significant. Let me give you an example. Through the 1990s, if you're looking at tax returns for the state of California, you had about 25,000 households each year report an adjusted gross income of $1 million or more. Then when the stock market bubble hit its very peak and then burst, when it hit its peak, we had 44,000 households report an adjusted gross income of $1 million or more. Can you imagine the great leap? And the next year, after the stock market bubble burst, we went back to 24,000 households report an adjusted gross income of $1 million or more. Or if you want more relevant information, in 2002, $33 billion of capital gains was earned by Californians. In 2005, $111 billion at capital gains were earned, so over 3 times as much. And imagine you taking a portion of that for taxes. So that's how volatile the stream is for personal income taxes, which is the largest component of the state's tax revenues, making up anywhere from 49 to 53% of state tax revenues in any given year. I had a more surgical strike, which I tried to offer a couple years ago. The governor was offering that 10-year path. I said, why don't we look at the capital gains that are earned? And in years where you have significant capital gains that are earned, the legislature, the governor, they can work together and say, if, let's say, for example, capital gains is over 10% of personal income taxes for a given year, why don't you take a portion of that, what's earned north of that, and set it aside in creating a rainy day fund? And if that's too much because, let's say, some of the Democrats are concerned about other types of programs, then why don't we create a band, let's say 10 to 13%? If we did that for two fiscal years this year when we were doing very well in terms of tax revenues, we would have been able to set aside $11 billion before we had that significant debt, and we would have significantly dropped the obligations and made the budgeting process much more easier for the governor and legislature.
Prop 1A and Prop 1B essentially look down the road. I mean, they're not going to provide California with any money essentially right now. The other three, though, Prop 1C, which is the state lottery modernization, Prop 1D, which takes some money from the tobacco tax fund, and Prop 1E, which takes money from mental health funds, all are actually figured into this coming budget. We have a question here that asks, what happens if those others, Prop 1C, Prop 1D, and Prop 1E, don't pass? What's the financial implications for the state? And we'll start with John Myers again.
Well, the easy answer is about $6 billion bucks. Somewhere in that neighborhood. There's about $5 billion in 1C of borrowing and lottery revenues. There's somewhere close to $1 billion, maybe it's a little bit less, out of 1D and 1E for the budget year that begins on July 1st. So that, right, that was written into that $40 billion solution. That's about $6 billion they'd have to come up with. But I can't say those without also mentioning that the economy and the state's revenues have worsened since that budget deal was signed in February. The legislative analyst estimates that we're $8 billion in the red for that year that begins in July 1 already. So if you take the $8 billion that the ledger analyst says is worse than we were when the budget was signed, and you take the $6 billion that are tied up in 1C, 1D, and 1E, and let's say they don't pass, which the polls are saying right now that they might not, that's $14 billion worth of red ink that lawmakers would have to solve in the year beginning July 1st. That doesn't even account for what the controller certainly knows better than anyone. Tax receipts haven't been coming in very well. That doesn't account for what's going on in the current budget year. But, you know, shorthand is $6 billion out of those budget measures.
Now, when we talk about these issues, though, every issue on that has its people in favor and its people against. There's a major question when you talk about 1C, which is the lottery, and that question is how deep should the state get into gambling? The talk is by modernizing it, you raise more revenue. The only way you raise more revenue is by having more people play. Is this a concern that runs pretty deep? What do you think, Sean Randall?
I know it certainly runs deep among some people. We've approved a ballot, rather we've approved the lottery in the past. We have it. A lot of people use it. So I don't sense, although John might disagree, if I'm off base here, that there's a tidal swell of opposition based on opposition to gambling. I think it's more, if there's opposition, it's this question of continuing to borrow against future revenues. I think it's being presented also, certainly when the governor first came up with this idea last year, as actually a reform of the lottery process to make it modernized and more efficient. So I guess there's an anti-gambling argument there, but I see that as probably secondary to the fiscal issues about this looking just like another aspect of a very big mess.
Well, I think what's fascinating is that ask every political consultant, frankly, ask every reporter, every politician. When people ask about the lottery, they say, well, I thought education was getting a lot of money out of the lottery. It's the number one question in California. It's funny how many political consultants say they do focus groups, and it always comes up, the lottery and education. The reality is that the lottery has never provided a large amount of money that we spend on education. It was about $1 billion in one of the last years that was measured. Now, $1 billion is still $1 billion, but when you look at the budget for education in California, it's somewhere north of $50 billion, depending on what year you're talking about. So depends on how much you define as important. The biggest change out of 1C that I think is not quite clear by the term lottery modernization is this. 1C simply removes education from the lottery forever. That's the only modernization. The initiative written in 1984 said you had to give 34 cents of every dollar in profits to education. 1C says education has nothing to do with the lottery anymore. All the profits go to investors in exchange for giving us this $5 billion up front. Maybe there'll be some money left over for the state general fund. Education gets more money now, would get more money under Prop 98 if 1C passes, which will probably cost the state more in the long run. But that's the big modernization. That's the big change. And maybe then people will stop asking how the lottery impacts education, but I would doubt it. I think that's really fundamentally ingrained in what people think in California.
John Chang?
And I'm very concerned that the taxpayers don't get the short shrift with this lottery securitization. If you looked at the numbers as this proposal was originally presented a year ago, we're talking about for the same lottery securitization $15 billion, and then suddenly we're talking about $5. Right, we have constricted financial markets. The cost of borrowing is very expensive. Are we going to get the $5 billion? And if we get the full $5 billion, how much are the taxpayers of California going to have to pay for it?
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today, we're discussing the California budget. Our panelists are John Chang, California State Controller, John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief, KQED Public Radio, Sean Randolph, President and CEO, Bay Area Economic Forum, Fred Silva, Senior Fiscal Advisor, California Forward. Well, when you talk about the ballot measures in the May 19th special election, the immediate question that comes up to me and to a number of people in our audience is, what happens if these don't pass? And that's a question I'm going to go through the panel with, and we'll start with Fred Silva.
Well, let's assume for the moment that the voters don't approve all of them. Then the current budget, the current budget agreement that was adopted in February, has a larger hole in it. So the getting agreement to get a balance for the 9-10 year is more complicated. As John mentioned a moment ago, it's probably worth a $6 billion. That makes the whole $6 billion bigger. But I think what one of the larger problems is that California will get a new governor in 2011. Out of the 2010 election. And this arrangement in February was constructed so that the tax measures included the so-called limitation on spikes in revenue would all go together so that the next governor would at least have the benefit of these temporary taxes for two additional years, that is the 2011-12 and 12-13 budget. That will go away. So the hole that will be met by the new governor, whoever he or she is, will simply be quite a bit larger.
Sean Randolph.
Well, if they fail, I think it does push the electorate potentially more toward the nuclear option we discussed earlier of the Constitutional Convention. Yet I think it's very unlikely that in a new budget negotiation in Sacramento that we would see new taxes. I think it was hard enough to get Republicans to agree to the tax measures that are on the ballot right now. And those who actually broke ranks and approved that are subject to recall by members of their own party. So I don't think you can squeeze much more blood out of that stone in terms of tax increases. Which means unless we find other ways to borrow, it's squeezing services more. And that's going to be an awfully tough discussion. And I think that if the discussion last year and up to February was bloody and awful, this one is going to be bloodier and more awful. And I think as people watch that and watch that potential disarray, I think that may make their interest in some kind of large-scale systemic fix maybe more immediate. So I think it's going to push some of these big structural issues forward much more rapidly.
John Myers.
Well, a couple of just quick things. First of all, I think everyone will read into the results what they want to read into them if it fails on May 19th. On May 20th, the anti-tax groups will say, see, we told you, nobody wanted to raise taxes. The other side will say, see, nobody wanted to cut services or whatever their particular partisan feelings are. From a practical sense in the legislature, I can't see, I think Sean's exactly right, I can't see a tax increase coming, in which case, what gimmick can the legislature come up with to try to figure out what to do, hoping the economy gets better? I wrote down a few of them. Some of them actually aren't gimmicks, but I wrote down a few things. No one has talked about the fact that we passed a protection on local government funding a few years ago, Proposition 1A. It does allow us to borrow money from local governments and pay it back. It's not a great deal for the state government, but it's better than having nothing. Prop 98, which is school funding. I can't imagine someone won't discuss suspending Prop 98 and maybe cutting school funding again, which no one's in favor of, but it is the largest chunk of the budget. And then my favorite gimmick of the last few months, just because for its you got to give them an A for creativity. I don't know, depending on your feelings, what you give them about validity of it. It's a majority vote tax increase. How this would work, you say? Our Constitution says 2/3 for a tax increase. Ah, but therein lies the rub. It depends on what you call a tax increase. There is an opinion circulating in Sacramento. The Legislative Council has looked at it. A majority Democrats have looked at it. There's some wonder whether this tax commission that has been empowered to look at modification of the tax structure in California has looked at it, where if you raise one tax and you lower another tax, and effectively it is a revenue-neutral move, is that really a tax increase? Now, you would think, well, that doesn't solve our problem. But, yes, if you raise taxes on things that are paid out of the general fund, then you have more money in the general fund where the deficit exists. And maybe you lower a tax or a fee that deals with some other specific thing in California. It's controversial. It would absolutely get challenged in the courts. But, again, people are going to look for a third way around cuts and tax increases, and I wouldn't be surprised to see it come up.
John Chang, what's the prospect for the state if these don't pass?
I stopped short of my earlier conversation about the cash management steps because I wanted to save time, but I'll go through them now because it will have huge implications. First is the use of the general fund revenues, which are the income taxes, personal income taxes, corporate taxes, and the sales tax. That's the first step of cash management. Second, I also reference is the use of special funds, the 650 funds of which we borrowed in excess of $16.5 billion. The third step that we do nearly annually is we go out to the external market and borrow money for cash flow purposes. Today, to borrow from Wall Street, it is very, very expensive. And as all of you well know, we are now the lowest credit rated state. We were downgraded a couple months ago, basically, because of the cash situation and budget situation we had. But also, they said the failure of the governor and legislature to come to agreement about coming up with a sound solution. The fourth step is the governor and the legislature coming to agreement. I do agree. I don't think that there's going to be any additional taxes, so that there's going to have to be significant spending cuts. Hopefully, no more gimmicks, such as more borrowing, because it's only going to make our problem worse, not only for the long term, but for the short and medium term. That's what we're facing today. The fifth step we experienced, it's something I did not like to do, but my obligation to all of you in this room and the listening audience and all of California is to make sure that California does not go into default. Under federal law, we cannot file for bankruptcy, but we can go into default, and you can imagine what happens with a bankruptcy. Everybody's suing, trying to get your money. You have no cash to pay your bills. Nobody will loan you money, all essential for cash management. That would happen in the state of California. So I have to do what some households do, defer to make sure that we have enough cash so that we can make the major obligation. Under the Constitution, the top two obligations are to education and then to debt service. My obligation is to make sure don't default on debt service, then we have a total calamity. The sixth step is issuing IOUs. A lot of people confuse cash deferrals with IOUs. We did not issue IOUs. We try not to issue IOUs because then you set up a legal sequence by which you have to pay your bills. So if I gave John an IOU for an obligation and I have to make that obligation. Let's say the next day I owe a payment to Fred, who's Wall Street, who I at all costs want to pay because I don't want the state to go into default. By paying John, I may not have enough cash to pay Fred. That's why we try not to issue IOUs unless we really have to. And then the next step would be the default. And so that's the consequences of what would take place, making it more difficult if they don't come to agreement.
Controller Chang, I'm going to stay with you for another question here. One of the possibilities for the people have suggested for solving California's budget problems is money from somewhere else, for example, the federal government. We have one person in our audience asked, what effect will federal funds have on the budget agreement, and do they meet the projections?
Actually, that's sort of the replacement at looking at increased taxes for this year. If you look at Governor Schwarzenegger, if you look at the Treasurer Bill Lockyer, the state banker, and I, we've been trying to look at the financial instruments and mechanisms, perhaps the timeliness of assistance from the federal government to make sure that perhaps we can reduce the cost, saving millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to the taxpayers of California. But this is tough sledding. If you look at a budget, there is no panacea, right? You're not going to solve right now an $8 billion budgetary deficit. You're not going to solve a $10.6 billion cash deficit. So we're going to have to look at every tool in our toolkit. One of the things that I also want to encourage those in Sacramento is give me the audit authority to try to save taxpayer dollars, right? That's, frankly, also how we can build trust. I have very few unearmarked auditors in the controller's office. I've been trying to do everything I can. So, for instance, we've been auditing the debt collection practices of state agencies to see, hey, I understand you have other essential core functions, but one of your most important core functions today has to be making sure that if you assess a fine against a fly-by-night telecommunications company by the PUC, you also need to collect those dollars. Those dollars added in aggregate add up to a lot of money and will help us with our budget difficulties.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question, and we'll go through the panel and see what they have to say. And the question, quite frankly, is a very open-ended one. It's when are the budget problems going to be solved? Again, is there light at the end of the tunnel? The same question we asked down the line. I mean, some people say, well, if we just eliminate the two-thirds, it would be fine. Other people say, well, if we eliminate the disconnect between spending and taxes and spending. What are the answers, and what's actually down the road? And we'll start with Sean Randolph on this.
Well, I don't think that eliminating the two-thirds solves it. It'll give you a budget more quickly, but it won't address the structural issue. I think ultimately the question of striking the balance between revenues and expenditures is at the core of it. And then the question is, how do you get there? And so there are initiatives being led by California Forward that would take us there. Again, there's a constitutional convention idea. Either way, where we're looking out several years, we're talking about 2011, 2012. So these aren't fixes that happen very, very quickly. So I think in the meantime, we're looking at least a couple of years of struggling with the budget, sort of in a piecemeal, patch-it-together way that we have now. But that doesn't detract in any way from the importance. It actually increases the importance of coming up with that structural fix, which, again, I think is still several years away.
Fred Silva.
Well, California Forward, as I mentioned earlier, has a set of proposed reforms that we think will bring greater fiscal balance to the state. There are five of them. You can see them at caforward.org. And basically they're this. One of them is to get out of our short fiscal horizon, which is an annual event, to go to a multi-year budgeting system. Other states are beginning to recognize that a longer fiscal horizon allows you to control costs better over a longer period of time, is able to assist in this volatility problem with revenues. So the first thing is a multi-year budgeting system. The second is to embed performance measurement into the expenditure side of the budget. We use this current services model that says you get what you got in the prior year plus growth, compressed again into a 12-month period. So we're suggesting a multi-year budgeting apparatus with a performance measurement at the core of determining expenditure priorities. The third is we're suggesting that the legislative process that goes about deliberating on the budget needs to be overhauled significantly to gather consensus earlier. We're suggesting that a Joint House Budget Committee be responsible for developing the budget. The fourth element is a pay-as-you-go system that I mentioned earlier, and the final one is to get a handle on this volatility problem to even out state revenues.
John Myers, briefly.
Well, it's tough. I mean, as a reporter, I really don't know the answer, and I look for other people to find it. But it seems to me, just by watching it, you got to kind of go one of two ways: more politics or less politics. It's kind of the way I was thinking of it. More politics, let the voters decide more of it, but also put a ramification in it. When the voters don't want to do X, Y, or Z, X, Y, or Z service has to go away. I mean, there is this feeling of a disconnect that people don't see that, that government continues to operate even in the middle of all this red ink. And maybe less politics, which is the one that a lot of reform groups talk about. Open primaries, redistricting, something that allows lawmakers a breathing room to make decisions not based on political calculations all the time. Term limit reform, something to that.
And real quick, John Chang, controller.
At the heart of the matter, you need responsible leaders who are willing to make the tough decisions, who will put the public good ahead of self-interest.
Thank you all. Thank you to all our panelists. John Chang, California State Controller. John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief, KQED Public Radio. Sean Randolph, President and CEO, Bay Area Economic Forum. Fred Silva, Senior Fiscal Advisor, California Forward. And we also thank our audiences here and on the radio. This program is generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. I'm John Wildermuth, and now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thanks, John.
All right, you too.
Yeah.